This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Expect experts galore on this show. We were joined live on the line by Legal Eagle, Ludmila Yumalova. She was talking about the property boom and had advice for first-time home buyers here in the UAE, plus taking your questions on everything from prenups to golden visas. And we were asking, how do you talk to your kids about money? Do they think it grows on trees? Is this cashless society confusing everybody? A new app is aiming to introduce financial literacy and offer something of a service to those teenagers and parents who want to become more financially literate. And one Dubai dad, Tim Peters, thinks he has it sorted. We were picking his brains. And in light of news that countless fines have been handed out to kiosks and stores here in the UAE for bad customer service, pushy sales, what is your big pet peeve? Is it being followed around stores or completely ignored? We were speaking to an expert about what staff can be doing to make sure the customer is happy.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Time for our resident Legal Eagle to land, Ludmila Yumalova, joining us. Ludmila Yumalova, as I just said regarding the traffic, Dubai is back. I've had issues getting parked. I've been stuck in traffic. Lots of people talking about surcharges on certain transportations, and property is absolutely part of that. So I've got some friends moving because they always come back. They left Dubai a couple of years ago. They're coming back to Dubai. Can they find a villa? No, they cannot. So let's talk about the property boom. Villas super popular. We've really seen this during the pandemic, people wanting more space and certainly some good value on offer for quite some time. And most of the buyers of those villas are the end users. So I'd love you this afternoon to share some advice, if you wouldn't mind, when it comes to first-time home buyers here in the UAE.
Well, hello, and that's a great topic to discuss. And we certainly, as you rightfully said, have been quite busy with all real estate-related subjects, be it buying, selling, renting, moving, property visas. So there's a lot that is driving the real estate market, and for all good reasons. Now, some of the interesting reports is we just had a client where the landlord claims that the property prices have gone up triple in 1 year.
Whoa.
Triple. So just to give you a flavor of what's going on in the real estate market. So I guess for many of us, that could potentially be good news because that means the economy is strengthening, or so we hope. And yes, we have had a number of clients who are either selling or buying, so the market is certainly moving. With respect to what we would advise, one is, much depends obviously on whether the property is being bought with cash or with a mortgage, because I'd say some so different considerations should be taken into account depending on your financial situation. But generally speaking, I'd say number one is just to inspect the property properly, because a lot of the times what we hear is that someone has made a commitment and paid deposit and signed agreements only to later find out, for example, the property needs to the drainage system, for example, needs to be fixed, or that there is a smell that they cannot get rid of, or, for example, that it's close to a garage door in a neighboring unit that's causing noise. And then at that point, it's often a little too late to back away from the deal without losing some kind of a sum, at least a deposit. So I'd say number one, just due diligence in terms of the property itself, the specifications of the property. Number two is the due diligence about who you're buying from or who is buying, because parties do matter. For example, the sellers could be multiple parties, and yet there's somebody else that's representing them. So you want to make sure that you know exactly who is selling and who is representing, and you have all the documents ahead of time. And then I'll also agree on the timing of the transaction and the deposit, because often what happens is that parties would give the deposit, agree on the timing, and then for one reason or another, they're not able to meet that timing for the transfer date. And then there is a big squabbles about the deposits. Okay. And who has the right to keep the deposit and such. Generally speaking, my biggest advice is don't rush. right now, because of this sort of hype in the real estate market, there's a lot of pressure. It's like, I want to close the deal now. You have to sign the document now.
There's other people interested.
It's an investment. Okay. So I'd say due diligence and take your time and read and understand what you're signing before you commit.
We've had a question relating to property this afternoon from Tom, saying, an unexpected afternoon of working from home, so I get the pleasure of your company. Great to have you with us. I recently bought a house which is tenanted, but I want to move into it. I have the legal notice from the notary public and have registered this with the court. The question is, does the 12-month notice start from the date notice is served, or can I only apply for 12 months from the end of the existing tenancy contract, which is not does not expire until the end of December? So Tom has a house. Tom wants to live in his house. What does he need to know about doing that legally?
A great question. It's 12 months after the date that the tenant received the notice.
Okay. Hope that helps, Tom. If there's any clarification that you need, please do reach out.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmila Umalova, she is our legal eagle from HPL Malvern Blücher. So we've got a question here from Linda, Ludmila, saying, my office lease expires at the end of 2021, but my trade license, July 2022. I'm working from home. What is the final consequence if I don't find a new office before July? Thank you.
So the license, in order to renew the license, the authorities do require proof that the lease, the underlying lease that's attached to the license, is renewed. So if it is not renewed for one reason or another, one reason being that the listener cannot find an alternative office, the option is to switch from the physical office to what's called a flexi desk. Certain authorities, certain free zone authorities, for example, or other economic zones, have an option of a flexi desk. And with, I guess, sort of the consequences, one of the positive consequences of coronavirus is that a lot of economic zones have offered many different types of licenses these days that are a lot more flexible. One of the benefits is that there are many more licenses now that exist without the requirement of a physical office. So it may be actually possible to switch the current license away from physical office and in favor of a flexi desk, which in practical terms can also not just be cheaper or more affordable, but also just less management, not having to deal with actual physical office management. So that's perhaps one advice.
That's great that there's been more flexibility and understanding that people have different requirements, whether that is time or traveling or cost as well. So Linda, ask that question, see if it's possible to change the terms. Anonymous message here on 4001, Ludmila, saying, I've read many articles about the non-compete agreement, and apparently it has no legal status. Can you please clarify on that? It's an interesting one, because when I moved here 15 years ago, everyone talked about, you know, non-compete, and if you leave a company, then, you know, you're knackered because you couldn't possibly work in the same industry. It seems less and less common, and perhaps far less enforced than it was traditionally. What is the latest on that, legally speaking?
Yes, well, let me just kind of separate. There's two concepts. There is a non-competition, concept or agreement, which is an employment concept. And then there is the labor ban, which in the past, which is when you and I came here, was a lot more common. And that is, apart from what was in your agreement or not, at the time, the practice of placing employees under an employment ban was a lot more common. And that was irrespective of the legal concept being non-competition. So the employment ban has been used a lot less for over many, many years, and to the point of perhaps where in most cases it doesn't even exist anymore. Now, the non-competition, that's a legal principle that still exists in the UAE law and has always existed, by the way. And it's subject to the UAE labor law, and it's derived from the UAE labor law. And in short, the concept does exist. However, it's the application is a lot less common or a lot less pervasive as people may think. And that is because while the concept of non-competition is a principle, legal principle, the courts here do enforce, it really has to, in order to be enforceable, it has to be very narrowly tailored. Mm-hmm. So in other words, non-competition agreement, in order to be valid, it has to be very specific in terms of specific and limited in scope, in terms of geography, time, and the scope of the responsibilities, for example. So let's take legal practice. I cannot prevent anybody who worked for me to ban them from working in the legal field for 1 year. Just because what else are they going to do? The general concept is the courts here will not enforce an agreement, a non-competition agreement, that ultimately has the effect of preventing somebody from practicing their trade.
That makes sense.
Earning a living. Also, any kind of non-competition that prevents somebody from working anywhere in the UAE is too broad, is unenforceable.
Okay.
Any kind of non-competition that prevents somebody from working in a particular industry for 2 years or even 1 year, similarly is unenforceable.
Okay, that is very useful in itself.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmila Yamalova, I hope you've had your coffee. We have got a free legal clinic this afternoon and Dubai's most in-demand expert is with us live on the line. Ludmila, we have got a full range of issues and questions from our lovely listeners. Let's start with an anonymous message here saying, if you don't have a will or temporary guardians assigned in Dubai and both parents die, is a 16-year-old boy old enough to take care of his 12-year-old brother contacting adult family friends for help until a legal guardian arrives from abroad? If not, what would happen? What does the law say in terms of technically being an adult under those circumstances, Ludmila?
Well, a 16-year-old boy is not old enough to take care of his siblings. So the age of majority in the UAE is 21, the official age of majority, though a lot of other things can be done at the age of 18, such as driving and working, for example. But for purposes of guardianship, there's a requirement of being at least 21. So in this particular case, first of all, it would be best if the family are non-Muslims to have a will. And there are different options for wills, but one that's perhaps most tested and reliable at present, at least, is through the DIFC Will Center. So the DFC Wills Center does allow to include in the will the provisions for guardianship and custody in these kinds of circumstances. And there's specific language that exists as a proposed language. And in fact, there is a specific subset of a will as a template that is just for guardianship and custody at the DIFC Will Center that I would encourage all others who may be listening and considering this to at least, in the very least, consider that, if not the full will, but at least the guardianship provision.
Okay.
So in this particular case, I mean, what would happen is... the authorities are fairly flexible. It's all obviously about maintaining the stability of those who are left behind. There are a lot of concerns, and we've heard them over the year, that the state will come and take the children away. Mm-hmm. That is not true. It doesn't work that way. The authorities' objective is to try to cause as little sort of chaos, perhaps, and change as possible. So normally what happens is the authorities will come and they will either appoint somebody from, like a police officer, for example, to either be around the house just to make sure that the children are well protected and are safe. And usually if there are other relatives that live close by that at least have some kind of ability to look after the children or neighbors, they will allow those people to be with the family and with the children until the legal guardian, the permanent legal guardian, will come. Now, who is the permanent legal guardian is a more complicated issue because it really depends on the family dynamics. Sometimes, as often is the case in a lot of families in the UAE, parents can come from different countries, from different religions, and the children may have multiple passports different from their parents' passports. So the issue of guardianship can be quite complicated. So therefore, my advice is for those who are eligible, do think through this early in advance and make provisions to at least identify who that permanent guardian should be in the event of this unfortunate circumstance. But otherwise, just in the absence of the will, I want to put people's concerns at rest, that it's not the case that the state will come and the children will become part of the state. That's not at all true.
Thank you.
The authorities will locate someone who they believe is should be the permanent guardian. Usually it's a relative, grandmother or grandfather or aunts and uncles. And they will allow children to travel with them.
Okay, that's really, really useful. And no one likes thinking about this. It's an unpleasant thing to have to dwell on or plan. But as we've discussed so many times before, especially on the financial front, when someone's in the midst of grief, trying to locate bits of paper or life insurance policies, or in this case, you know, people to look after kids, it's so much better to have that admin all taken care of ahead of time. If you do have any questions related to that for Ludmilla, please do get in touch on 4001. A message here saying, my company is based in Dubai. A company in Abu Dhabi owes me 22,000 dirhams. How can I file a complaint? I've got invoices and delivery orders. Can we help out this listener, Ludmilla? What would the next step be?
Yeah, certainly. The easiest way to do it is what would be if there are invoices and payment orders that could constitute, in legal terms, a confirmed debt. With that kind of documentation, there may be an option to file a payment order request through the courts. And it would be, in this particular case, if the invoices are with an Abu Dhabi entity or for Abu Dhabi transaction, it could be done through the Abu Dhabi courts. Now, one of the blessings of COVID is that the courts have gone online. For the most part, all courts in the UAE are now online and they're very efficient, including Abu Dhabi courts. So the request for a payment order, for example, or an order on petition, which is another type of an expedited judicial request, is done through the online court access. So it doesn't matter where you are. You could be based in Dubai, but you can, as long as you have a login to the Abu Dhabi courts, which you can establish being resident, again, without having to go to the court, you can do it all online through the apps. You can file this expedited request, an order on petition, to get your 20,000 paid. And you can do it all on your own without having to have lawyers involved. You just need to make sure that your initial request is done in Arabic.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ludmilla. Really, really helpful. No name on this one. And that's absolutely fine with us. Really doesn't make any difference at all. And hopefully we can help as many people as possible between now and 3 o'clock. So get your messages in on 4001. My ex-employer wants me to show my new work visa before releasing my full and final settlement. Is this legal? I don't want them to know about my new job. Do they have to provide this? Is this part of the process?
No, it's not part of the process. You don't have to provide it. It just becomes a bit of a stalemate in this particular case. Or if, you know, which one is more important, just to get paid or to start your job, your new job. So what their ex-employer is doing is not proper and it's not legal. But the practical matter is that often companies do that. And then until you have given them the new visa, they won't release your end of service. And then you have to pay money to fight for it. And even though it's improper. So if it's a matter of principle, then don't sign. And then you can claim this end of service through, again, through the court, which once again, you can file online these days. But otherwise, you can educate them, but just manage your expectations.
Okay. I really hope that helps. All the best with the new job. Again, anonymous master saying, is it possible to open a new company under a second passport while having one company and visa already? Does that make sense to you?
Under the second passport? Well, not, I mean, it's, I guess in theory it's possible, but the authorities, I mean, it depends on what you're doing with that second passport, the second company. So if you're trying to get visa, residence visa through the company, then it will not be possible because here in the country, we are registered under one passport. It may be the authorities have copies of or record of your other passport, but you are here. We are here registered under one passport and only. So, for example, you're a British national. You're here registered only under the UK passport. You may have an additional French passport. But here you're considered to be a British citizen. And so at some point in time, depending on what you want to do with that second company, there may be mismatch in the system. And these days, there's a lot more as part of our initiative for digital transformation and e-government, smart government. A lot of these government authorities are becoming more and more integrated and cross-linked. So at some point in time, there may be a mismatch in passports, and there could be sort of practical nuances that will prevent you
nuances.
From
operating. nuances. Paperwork headaches, probably down the line.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmilla Malova with us from HPL Malvern Plukin. We're doing a bit of a quick fire round this afternoon. Ludmilla, message here saying, can you have a prenup agreement before marriage? This document as a legal entity in the UAE, even if the wedding is not expected to take place in the UAE. It's a non-Muslim marriage. What would you say to that about prenups?
Yes, you can have a prenup agreement, and a lot of people do that. The issue becomes as to where potentially it's enforceability. So in the UAE, you could, and in fact, even the laws here provide for the option of a prenuptial agreement. However, a lot of couples perhaps may want to enforce these agreements in their own respective countries, and then and not in all jurisdictions these prenup agreements can be enforced. So whatever it is you do, if you do a prenup agreement, it is possible, it is legal, the system provides for it here. You just need to be mindful if you do want to potentially enforce it in a different jurisdiction to seek legal counsel with regards to that particular jurisdiction and incorporate it, if possible, into your agreement here.
Okay, good luck and have a very wonderful wedding and happy marriage. No name on this message for obvious reasons that will become clear. A message asking on 4001, what happens if I accept a job offer and get my visa processed, but immediately after that I get another interesting and better job? Do I have to give a month notice during probation?
Generally speaking, no. The idea of probation is that either party can part ways without notice. But the way the law is actually drafted, it's the law per se. It gives that option to the employer, but with the option to agree to a mutual sort of parting of ways without notice. So in other words, look at your agreement specifically. But most employment agreements we have seen have that no notice probation option for it that applies to both parties. So if your agreement provides for that, then you do not need to give notice.
Brilliant. Okay. Hope that helps. And let us know what you decide. A message here, again, no name, saying my colleague and I were good friends until recently, but I found out she was sharing my messages, screen grabbing WhatsApps and sending them to other colleagues. Is this something I could take up with HR or is it above their pay grade?
If it relates to work, then certainly it's something that should be raised or could be raised to HR if it relates to work. But if it's your colleague and this is more all kind of done in terms of a friendly relationship, then maybe it's outside of the scope of their responsibilities, not so much of a pay grade, but rather of their scope of work. But if it relates to anything related to employment and sharing with other with other employees, especially if it's messages that perhaps would affect your reputation or privacy, then you should definitely raise it with HR and they should absolutely consider it.
Okay, I hope that helps. And Manu's been in touch saying, thank you for this. My company says I'm eligible for a golden visa, but who can I sponsor? I've got a wife and a child living with me here and a brother who lives in my home country. Can I sponsor them all?
You can sponsor everybody except the brother who lives outside the UAE. But the idea of golden visa is the entire family qualifies to for residency under the golden visa. So if, let's say, there's a father, then the son and the son's whole family, his wife and the children can also qualify, would qualify. But it really only applies to the non-married. So if, let's say, if it's your sister that's married, and then it would not apply to her because she would be under the sponsorship of her husband, for example. Equally so, if it's a brother that does not live in the UAE, then he would not qualify unless he's, for example, a minor brother, and then you have options or you have plans to bring him back into the UAE, then you could qualify.
Okay. Really hope that helps. Congratulations, Moni. And last question of the day is from Shumi saying, can you dismiss an employee for lying on his resume? We've hired someone, but he looks like he's learning on the job. What is the legal recourse, if any, in this situation, Ludmilla?
No, absolutely, you can. In general, in the UAE, employment is at will, and so you can always dismiss employee for whatever reason. In this particular case, if you think that he is lying, then you can and you should. My only note of caution is that make sure that if you do accuse him of lying, that your offer letter was specific enough where you can actually substantiate that particular accusation. But otherwise, if you feel that he's not what you were hoping for, then absolutely you have the right legal right, and I'd say practical authority to want to terminate him.
Interesting. False advertising on the resume. Ludmilla Maliva, thank you so much for your time this afternoon, answering the questions coming in real time. So thank you again. Really appreciate the clarity you've been able to offer, the many messages we've had in on 4001. And if you do, of course, need some one-on-one consultation, you can find Ludmilla at HPL in Melbourne Pluka, and she's back here on Dubai Eye in 2 weeks' time.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So who here has a child that thinks their parents' ATM card is bottomless? Where do you think your kids think your money comes from. We're moving towards a cashless society, and in honesty, as a parent, I'm finding that really hard to explain to my kids. I use my phone for everything. I often leave the house with just my keys and my phone, and we're able to go to the supermarket and, you know, get petrol. And it seems to be quite straightforward, but I do wonder about their associations between earning money, spending money. And many kids in Dubai, of course, have had to live with the reality of not having enough of it over the course of the pandemic. And for parents to explain this can be really, really challenging. One woman who's trying to change this is joining us now on Microsoft Teams. Smita Ghosh is the co-founder of Kashi. It's a fintech startup, an app that aims to teach kids about money management. Smita, thank you for being with us today. What do you think the general attitude is around kids and cash? What are some of the things you've heard over the years?
Thanks for having me, Helen.
Pleasure.
I mean, it's not just stuff that we've heard, Helen. We've also done, through Kashi, a massive amount of research in the UAE. We've had focus groups. We've spoken to over 250 parents. And what we've understood is that there's deep desire in parents to teach their kids, just like you said, about the value of money and the principles of money management, but there is no solution at hand. Parents are, over 80% of the parents we've spoken to are struggling to teach their children about money for various reasons. And they could be from, you know, I don't have the time, my kids don't listen to me, my kids don't have the time, I don't know what to teach, I don't know how to teach. So there are many, many reasons. And there isn't one solution that helps them. So that's why we felt that there was a big gap in the market. No one was addressing this problem, and we wanted to do something in this space.
It's particularly timely for me today, because this morning my kids said to me at breakfast, "Mummy, why do you have to go to work? Could you have a week where you don't go to work? Could you have a year where you don't go to work?" And I said, "You know why I go to work?" Hoping they would go, "Yes, because you love what you do," and blah, blah, blah. And Phoebe was like, "So you can be rich." I was like, no, I would like to be rich. I don't want to be rich. And she said, "Well, lions don't have to pay for a house, and monkeys don't pay for school, and, you know, they're fine." I'm like, please just finish your breakfast, because we've got to go to school. There doesn't ever seem to be a right time to have some of these conversations. And as I said, it's getting more and more complicated. Now, Smita, you're a Dubai kid. You grew up here. Was money an issue? What were some of the conversations you were having growing up?
That's actually one of the reasons why I even started Kashi. Is I grew up, it was a combination of growing up in India and then moving here in Dubai when we were, my sister and I, we were in the eighth grade. So I grew up here in my preteen and in my teen years. Now, money was never an issue, even though we didn't have a lot of it. But I remember growing up, the main lessons we learned about life in general was, you know, get good grades, get a great job, you know, study hard, you know, become a doctor or an engineer, and everything would be fine. But we didn't really get the nitty-gritties or the breakdowns of this is how you save, this is how you earn, this is how you grow your money. And I believe that if I were given these basics, or if I were trained on these basics, I believe my life, at least where it comes to money, would have been better, or could have been better. Mm-hmm. And I really wish this for the future generation. So your kids, my kids, you know, kids around me, I really want us to be able to make an impact in their lives.
It's still such a taboo subject, I think, for lots of families and cultures to talk to children about. You know, not necessarily we have this amount of money, but this is a worry for us, or this isn't a worry for us. Both sides tend to have some stigma and taboo about it. Taru's saying, "My nine-year-old says money actually grows on trees as it's made out of paper." But on a serious note, our children are age 9 and 13, very conscious about money and about spending it right.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Judith, thank you for getting in touch, saying our children are 15 and 7. We have really open conversations about how much money we have, our investments, what we're doing, how much we can spare, etc. Absolutely open about our financial situation to manage expectations. And I think that's really interesting in terms of that age group as well. We're joined now by Smita Ghosh. She's the co-founder of Kashi. It's a fintech startup, an app that aims to teach kids about money management. And I agree, Smita, I think there's been a huge gap in this, and for various reasons, and it still blows my mind that this isn't taught in school more openly and readily. Tell us a little bit about how your app works and how you're helping, hopefully, us as parents navigate some of these conversations.
Absolutely. So with Kashi, we're trying to teach children the basics of personal finance. So where we have features that cater to aspects of earning, saving, spending, and giving. And what we're doing is through our platform. So first of all, we offer a free mobile app and a Visa spending card for children. And what we're doing with this platform is we're encouraging money conversations in your everyday life. Because like you mentioned earlier, in this part of the world, and maybe in other parts of the world as well, money conversations are not necessarily very comfortable at home. And it's in quite some cultures, it's taboo. So we wanted to make it easier. We wanted to weave it into your everyday life. So you can, for example, create chores for your children. And once they complete it, you can send them money digitally. Children can create savings goals. And, you know, once you've achieved that goal, you know, boom, you can go and spend that money. So it's teaching them delayed gratification. And of course, earning money. So you can, you know, now in the UAE, the UAE government has actually acknowledged that, you know, teenagers, there's merit in getting teenagers to work. So they've allowed teens between the ages of 15 and 18 to get their own work permits and, you know, do part-time jobs. So in the future, we are going to have a feature that will allow teens to get paid directly into their Cashi app. So so what we're trying to do is really create a digital banking platform for teens without necessarily having to go to a traditional bank.
Okay.
And the wonderful part about Cashi is that it's free. And so there's absolutely no barriers to this.
What age group do you think it would be best suited to? I mean, my children are a lot younger than Judith, who's been in touch. You know, mine are 4 and 6, and they still have questions about money. We're still talking about introducing pocket money, for example. Who are you aiming this at?
So we are launching Cashi at the moment for kids between the ages of 13 and above. However, in the future, there is a possibility that we may be able to extend it for a wider age group, so perhaps from the ages of 10 and above. We do know from research that's been conducted in the past that kids as young as age 7 start really getting or understanding the concept of money, so earning money, the value of money, delayed gratification, etc. So there is no harm in letting children, even as young as 7 years, have access to an application or a service such as this, as long as you have, you know, adequate amount of parental control around it, you're able to monitor what the kids are doing. And if, you know, for any reason you felt that this was not convenient, you could stop it or even, you know, put in limits. And we have that as well. So if parents felt that, oh, my son or my daughter is perhaps a bit too young, even at 13, they can set up limits and, you know, just to keep themselves comfortable. So, you know, we're catering to all sorts of requirements.
Thank you so much for your time, Smita, today. The app, we've had a couple of messages, is called Cashi, which is cash and then double E at the end. And is it active now? It's on the App Store?
No, it's not. We're actually due to launch in a matter of weeks.
Okay.
But people can head over to our website to learn about the app.
Amazing. Thank you. And congratulations again.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking cash and kids this afternoon. What are some of the conversations you're having in your household regarding where money comes from, saving versus spending? Please let us know, the usual channels as well. Nicole saying, my child thinks I go to work, physically rake in money and shove it in my pocket so I can go home, use it to buy candy and toys. I've not bothered to correct her yet. Joined now by Tim Peters, a German expat, the father of three, and Tim reckons he has it sorted. Tim, thank you for being with us today. How are you?
Yeah, thank you, Helen. I'm very well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very interested to pick your brains, to be honest. I think this is a subject that an awful lot of parents really struggle with. How much information is appropriate for children when it comes to money? When should we start these conversations? So can you tell us how old your kids are, Tim?
Yeah, so I have three children, two boys. One is 14 years and the other one is 12, and then a daughter at 9 years old.
And can I ask you about your own upbringing? What were some of the conversations you had about money in your family?
Yeah, sure. I'm originally from Germany, and I guess I was educated with, you know, the kind of typical frugal financial rigor that you might know from Germany or from the German background. So very early on, I had my own bank account. I was taught that saving is good. I was, you know, given pocket money. I was given, you know, a bit of money for the grades in school, likewise by the grandparents, not just by the parents or by the uncles and aunts. And then, you know, we had to, I guess, budget well with the money that we had and couldn't just spend it, you know, on anything. So, yeah, that's my background.
And then how do you think that's informed the way you parent and talk about money with your own children? Are you doing anything differently?
Yes, I think, you know, all of us have to nowadays because times have changed. But first of all, I think Dubai for expats bears a very different environment. So I think here children and the parents are kind of caught between a financial rock and a financial hard place in a way, because I think on the one side, Dubai obviously exposes a lot of, rich environment and a bit of bling bling and all of that that is doubtlessly reflecting on the kids, meaning that, you know, money seems to fall from the trees. There's a bit of that. At the same time, there's no access directly to banks for the youth segment when they're very young. And thirdly, I think, we, or at least us expats, tend to be far away from the grandparents and from other parts of the family that also typically play a role in helping to set up savings and educate on the financial front. So I think that bears a bit of a, very different environment. And at the same time, I think the market has changed so fast. A, there's digital access. B, there's, new currencies like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And then there's even new models of investing or making money through gaming and mining of Bitcoin. And I think that in itself is an environment that requires us parents to approach differently from the past.
I think you're absolutely right. Context is absolutely key. And growing up in Dubai, I look at my kids and I look at them and go, you don't know how lucky you are. And they don't know how lucky they are because they were born here and they were raised here and, they've got a very, lucky, lovely life. But it's really important to me to try and keep them grounded. And we try and do that through, charity initiatives and talking about different families and different backgrounds and why people work and, why I work and that kind of thing. But where I kind of struggle to talk about with my kids is if they ask for something and I want to say no. And sometimes it's for financial reasons. Sometimes it's because I just simply don't want them to have it. I don't want to frighten them by saying, we don't have money for that. But I don't want them thinking that, we're right. Really struggling. It's just not priority. So I wondered how you've dealt with that over the years. What I'm trying to do is say, we're saving money so we can, buy plane tickets to go home and see, Granny Babs and Papa. Or, we're saving our money so we can do this or buy that. What's worked for you over the years, Tim?
Yeah, so various levers and probably a mix of different things. So on the one side, we've established a kind of a pocket money payment, and we're keeping account of that through an app online, where every week each one gets a certain amount depending on the age, and can save that up. That's one element. Then the grandparents have stepped in and have started to set up saving accounts back in Europe, back in Germany for them. And they're aware of that and they keep putting money into it at occasions, like Christmas or birthday. And they kind of can track how the money evolves with maybe a bit of interest rate behind that as well. And then, to be honest, Alan, when they do come and say, my friends are going to the cinema or they're going to Wild Wadi or wherever, I actually have started saying, yes, you can, but you have to take it from your pocket money. We have to, save for that. Or if they want a new iPhone or a Kindle of kind, then, we're trying to use the app where they can actually save up on these items.
Because these things are special. Going to Wild Wadi is a treat. It really is. Neither should there be an expectation that our children have the latest gadgets. And I worry about that being a trap that so many families fall into, that you start to feel, self-conscious if your kids don't have that. And, I'm thankfully my kids are a bit too young for that right now. But those social pressures, I think, are really significant. And birthday parties, I hope the pandemic's pressed a bit of a reset button on those because they were getting a little bit extravagant. You mentioned pocket money there, Tim, and I'm just curious. Do they have to earn it? Is that related to chores or is it just a set amount that you're happy to give them, just as a matter of course?
No, that's a set amount that they get on a weekly basis. Obviously, the 14-year-old gets slightly more than the 9-year-old, but they get this on a regular basis without any chores or anything. But then, if they if there's a certain task that we have, like cleaning up the garden or having to do a certain chore, we might throw in some extra money. Or when they get the report cards, mm-hmm. and they have an A+, we might pay on top of that. The pocket money is coming just regularly like that, but it's a small amount. It's maybe a small double digit dirham amount. But so that they see how they can grow it and invest it and either go to Wild Wadi or have an extra visit at the cinema or buy some popcorn there, so that they start feeling what that takes.
Exactly. Sometimes it's about making mistakes as well. realizing that you've bought a piece of tat and it really wasn't worth saving up for. It should be.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Where do you think, your kids reckon money comes from? We're talking about kids and cash this afternoon, and many of you reaching out, getting in touch with what's working and indeed not working in your household. Dubai dad of three, Tim, is live on the line. And sounds like he's got it sorted. He's got 14-year-old, 12-year-old and 9-year-old. And Tim, thank you for your honesty this afternoon. I think it's really important we have conversations like this so other parents know it's okay to be talking about this with our kids. And I certainly don't want to, say you've got to go home and sit your children down around the kitchen table and talk about money. It seems to be, having spoken to Kashi up earlier and you now, that it's weaving it into the day-to-day life. It's not having big conversations. It's just an ongoing dialogue. Is that the case in your family?
Yeah, look, in fact, I would even go further. I would even go as far as to say we can learn from our children, because essentially they're closer to the digital world. They understand the whole world of cryptocurrency probably better than we do.
Definitely better than me.
And they are more prone to use the tools, So mm-hmm. For example, we use a Euro-based, European-based app. I'm quite looking forward to have something more local like Kashi, where they could also have a local dirhams card or push money in real time. I think that's what's missing in this region still. So mm-hmm. Giving them the opportunity to experiment and test around with some of the money that they've been saving, even investing it in let's say virtual portfolios and stocks, and I think with their way of looking at things, we can even learn as a family and have these conversations around digital, so we may be able to speak to where the traditional money comes from, and we may know a bit more about saving and interest rates. But these times have changed, and I think some of what the children are following, so my second son, for example, he's very interested in these cryptocurrencies and in how the financial world is evolving, and he's already setting up virtual portfolios, and let them fail maybe investing on a virtual portfolio before they put the real money in it. So have the conversations and be open to learn mm-hmm. as well from their side.
Message from Ian saying, tell us about the Dubai kids' birthday parties. I don't know if you actually want me to tell you about them, but on my way to work today, I was thinking about kind of saving money. I was like, I might just go to IKEA, get the hot dog and the ice cream deal. 5 dirhams a kid. Done. Question from, more of a comment from Miro here saying, my issue here is that kids don't get lunch money, or, our kids rarely actually encounter it. On weekends, we send them to swimming and football, and they haven't asked about it. They're 4 and 6. When do you think it's too early? I think that's a really good point. What age would you recommend starting to introduce the concept of earning, saving and spending?
I think the sooner the better. So basically when they start being able to consume and walk up to a stand and buy something by themselves, whether this is popcorn or anything, as soon as they can ask for a soda pop or a lollipop or whatever, I think you can start introducing it, even by giving them a certain amount in cash to begin with. So I think financial literacy and integration should come right along with writing and reading and digital literacy, which happens earlier and earlier.
And lastly, I remember studying for my A levels and friends of mine being incentivized by cash. Their parents saying, if you get an A, you'll get 50 quid. If you get a B, you'll get 25. Where do you mm-hmm. stand on that?
Yeah, so I was brought up just like that. In a family of three children, so I was the youngest, and I had the challenge that my older brother and sister were straight A students and always got the maximum out of their transport cards, while I was, you know, maybe a grade below that, and it always seemed less than them. But that's the way I was brought up, and I still see it as a kind of incentive, and I must admit I am. I had introduced that for our children as well. So I think, it can't harm. It should give a bit of an incentive, at least for A's and B's, and maybe below that you wouldn't reward, at least some form of that. And then we might say, in the end, if the report card looks very good, we're going to go out for a special dinner, mm-hmm. or maybe a day. A day at a park or something like that.
My kids have watched that Yes Day movie, and that seems to be the biggest motivation. They just want a day where I do not say no. So that could be something we work towards. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today. It is, exactly. I want them to feel part of the process, part of the decision, and some of those decisions are going to be financial, and I certainly want them to be more and more involved as they get older. So thank you for sharing what you're doing in your household. It sounds like your kids are going to be very financially savvy. That middle son needs to start giving some lessons, I think. Tell him, send him my way for a little crypto workshop. Really appreciate your time, Tim. Thank you again.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Tell us about your experiences. Do you feel pressured to buy something when you're in a store? You shouldn't. In the news last week, as many as 95 shops and kiosks were fined here in Dubai, and 10 others shut down for interrupting customers, forcing them to buy products as part of their promotional campaign. According to Dubai Economy's Commercial Compliance and Consumer Protection Sector, 91 fines, 96 warnings issued to violators across various shopping malls, and 4 fines and 9 warnings in the open markets as well. Joining us now to explore more, take your questions and your comments as well on customer service, so do feel free to get in touch, is Amani Erekat. She's the co-founder and general manager of SISA Marketing, shedding some light on what we want as customers and why pushy salespeople need to back off. Thank you for being with us, Amani. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Helen.
I'm interested to discuss this because I have been maybe a pushy salesperson. I've always really enjoyed sales. I've worked in shops. I've sold advertising space. I love it. But as a consumer, it's a very tricky line to kind of tread because you want service, but you don't want too much service. I'm curious to see what the surveys say around how effective some of these sales techniques are. And this is something you've been looking at. What do we know in terms of numbers?
Okay, so the first thing is that the loyalty, when we speak about customer loyalty, we'll see that 53% of customer loyalty is driven by the sales experience. So as you know, the loyalty is the holy grail for any business, and it's the main goal. It's really hard to achieve. And then if the salesperson ends up to be pushy or bully or one of these things, they'll never get to have a customer, because it's 57% is based on the customer experience. So if the customer will not have a good customer experience, then he'll end up not going back to the store and not buying and not trusting the salesperson at the first place.
And the thing is, I do really feel for those people in sales. It's been a really challenging market over the last couple of years. And we know there's a huge amount of pressure being put on them by their team leaders, by managers. Many of you getting in touch to share your experience as well. Actually, message echoing what I've just said here, saying it isn't the retail sales assistant we should be complaining about. It's the companies that employ them that are responsible. They need to pay proper salaries, give training and pay rises based on performance and experience. And Patrick saying, when the shop staff are just too pushy with, can I help you, blah, 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 just say, no, I'm just shoplifting. I do that, in the gated communities, that when you kind of go, hi, what are you here for? I'm like, just here to do some crimes, bye. And you do the wave and drive off quite quickly. So can I ask you, talking about that environment of pushy salespeople and really trying to hit the targets that have been put in place by companies that are just trying to pay their rent, really, how has the pandemic affected the behaviours of consumers and salespeople in store, money that you've been witnessing and hearing about?
Okay, when we look at the statistics, we'll see that you'll be surprised, but the customer service in Dubai has showed 7% improvement across all sectors. Why is that? Because businesses became more aware about what the customers are looking for. they adapted more flexibility. They became more like technology driven, and they showed more empathy. However, when it comes to individuals, when we speak about salespeople, unfortunately, we still see those pushy salespeople who are like having a generic sales pitch. But there is nothing worse than having a generic sales pitch, because you don't target the correct consumers. Mm-hmm. You'll waste time on spray and pray, as they say it. So you'll miss the chance or the time to focus on your really real potential customers.
I think, and I love this message from Kate saying, pushy Dubai salespeople put me off. I walk away, even if it's something I really want. Cosmetic shops are the worst. Exactly. Girls just want to look. They don't want someone hovering over ready to pounce. Kate, I agree with that. What we want even less is someone's looking at my eye bags and suggesting products. A guaranteed way of bringing down my self-confidence and ruining my day. Talking about bad customer service, what about good customer service? Anything you want to shout about? I actually had a really good experience at my bank yesterday. They said something was going to take 4 days. She took upon herself when I got the document I needed within 24 hours to call me. I went in, couldn't have done enough for me. I stuck my head around the door and spoke to the branch manager and just said, Marwa was fantastic. Just want to let you know how helpful your branch is. And honestly, the smile on her face was just, I was like, I'm so glad I took 10 seconds to do that. So let's celebrate the good as well.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Acquiring new customers is up to 25 times more expensive than keeping them. And bad customer experiences is a leading indicator of that customer churn. So it's really critical to keep your customers happy. Let us know your customer service pet peeves and let's celebrate those who are doing it really, really well. Let me know in the comments and in 4001. Joining us, the co-founder and general manager of SISA Marketing, Amani Erkat, is with us as we talk about how to do it well and what impact the pandemic's had. Gone to 4001 saying, I walked into an apparel store in a mall. The sales lady saw me and nothing. Seconds after, a white couple came after me. We're greeted with the sweetest good day I've ever heard in my life. Never came back to the store after that. That's exactly it. You know, good news travels fast, bad news travels faster. And no name on this one saying, I'm in the sales sector. I'm a manager. I empathize with salespeople who go through disrespect on a regular basis from people when they make simple phone calls you can politely refuse. Absolutely. Do not forget your manners, people. Amani, thank you for being with us today. And I think we can all agree there is a huge amount of stress on salespeople right now, especially when we look at the bricks and mortar store who are feeling the pinch in terms of online shopping booming over the course of the pandemic. So if we're not looking at sales targets, how else do you think companies can train and incentivize their teams so the customer isn't feeling pressured to the point of complaining?
Yeah, right. So the first thing, as you said earlier, they should focus on training. So I always say training, training, training before you conduct anything like a survey, before you run the mystery shopping program, before you think about like even a development plan, you have to train your staff. The staff should know what is expected from them and they should know how to do it. It's their basic right or the simplest right. The second thing is talk to your customers, see what they want. Mystery shopping is a very good tool to measure performance. Most of my customers or clients, they do base their incentive or staff incentive based on the mystery shopping results. If customers' feedback is good, I've seen people also looking at their Google reviews and Facebook reviews. So there are lots of ways to measure the happiness of the customer apart from the target or the performance of the sales person apart from how many products does he sell or does he achieve the target or not. So we highly recommend like the training comes first and then all the other tools afterwards.
We're going to be talking about mystery shopping after 1:30, what exactly it involves and could this be something you could be doing on the side, earning some money? Going to the text line 4001, Jamil saying the lack of authority or initiative people have is infuriating, working off a script and afraid to make a decision. I've experienced that before, you know, being put on hold, trying to get a decision made, getting stressed out, being put on hold again. Amani, what would you say there when, you know, you really need someone who can make a decision? As a customer, is it a case of asking for the supervisor again and again and again? Because we've only got so much time.
Yeah, you mean like when they want like someone to make a decision as a customer, you're looking for someone to make a decision or the Sorry, can you come again? I didn't get your question.
So as customers, how can we make sure we're getting good customer service when we're working from someone who might be quite low down the ladder and all they've got is a script and they've got no decision-making ability or power?
Yeah, I understand you now. So, okay, so the first thing, if you notice, especially after the COVID-19, people became more educated. They know what they want. They're more savvy. And they know how to sense a good salesperson and a genuine salesperson from a bad one. A good salesperson would be knowledgeable. He would show empathy and he would definitely listen to you more. He will not be pushy because he knows his product will sell itself. So it depends on how they present themselves as well. I mean, these pushy salespeople, I don't think they have good knowledge about their product, or they know how to shortlist their prospects when it comes to customers. So the customer can easily nowadays sense who sells a product that is going to add value and would make me come back as a loyal customer and recommend their brand to other people, and who is just selling to sell.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of celebrating the good, thank you, Ethel, for this thing. I walked into Jo Malone Mall, the Emirates, to buy one candle and walked out with more than just one candle. Met the shop consultant who took me through the whole history of Jo Malone, how I should select a perfume for my body, how I should mix them, create my own. I didn't feel pressured at all to buy, but amazed at such a wonderful shopping experience and the knowledge of the product. Was broke, but happy with the experience and the purchase. And I bet you, Ethel, will go back. Caroline saying, I also hate being put on hold and forgotten about. And Ford said, this is more for online, but I really think the majority of companies need to stop using COVID as an excuse for absolutely terrible customer service. If I hear one more time I'm working remotely, or please bear with us, some people are doing it better. Stop the excuses.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking customer service this afternoon, delighted to be joined from CISA Marketing by Imani Elkat. She's a co-founder and general manager. As we talk about some of your pet peeves, but also celebrate the good. And we're talking about mystery shopping as well. So if you've had any experiences of that, get in touch 4001. Alia saying, I work in specialist retail and you cannot underestimate what a lift we all get when a happy customer lets us know. If you've had a good experience, email the customer services or director of the small store. Trust me, they will be grateful. And Carla, I am in 100% agreement. Carlo saying, I'm always cautious of complaining in restaurants because of what they might do to my food. Yeah. Maybe complain at the end before you get your dessert. Imani, thank you for being with us this afternoon. For anyone who's not familiar with the concept of a mystery shopper or mystery shopping, can you explain what role they play and who benefits?
Okay, so yeah, mystery shopping is a marketing tool that allows the business owners or the managers to evaluate the performance of the staff by sending regular people like yourself and myself who act like a regular customer. So they have to really keep a low profile. They go through the regular experience, then they come back and fill a survey online that evaluates their whole experience from the time they made the first interaction with the staff, whether it's via phone call or they walked into the store itself, till they pay the bill and leave the store. Of course, it covers the whole experience from A to Z, including the first impression, the ambience, the lighting, the cleanliness, the staff grooming, the display, the attitude of the staff, the interaction that took place, the upselling techniques. So everything that makes the customer experience in general. So after the mystery shopper fills this report, which usually happens online, it gets like interpreted into scores where we can measure the areas of strength and weakness in any business. Ideally, this should be repeated on certain patterns and in different timings to allow a maximum picture of what's happening inside the store on peak and off-peak period when there is lots of stuff, there is like less stuff. Mm-hmm. Lots of customer, like when there is no much customers in the store, and then we get the comprehensive result that allows us to take the full picture of what happens at all times and what are the majority of responses are saying in terms of customer experience.
And presumably the mystery shoppers are paid for their time, correct?
Of course, yeah. It's a part-time job where they get paid by assignment, of course.
And then are those tend to be facilitated by agencies or companies such as yourself? I'm just really thinking if anyone's listening and thinks, actually, this is something I could fit around my life, or I'm looking for a bit of a side hustle. Can you explain how people could become a mystery shopper, Imani?
course. The first thing, they should have passion for customer service. Okay, some people also think mystery shopping is a very easy job. No, it's not. It needs lots of dedication, commitment, and time management skills, besides an eye for detail, which is really important. Mystery shopper, people who are interested to become mystery shoppers, they can go to our website or any other agency's website or register themselves as mystery shoppers. They have to take some tests in terms of observation skills and English tests. Then we do an interview and we send them for trial visits where we measure their writing skills and their observation skills and their compliance with the regulations we give them. Mystery shopper needs to do this job on his free time. It's not a full-time job. It's always a part-time job. And they need to find the time to write the report afterwards. Okay. They need to have also a device to take good pictures, and they need to have a computer and internet at home to fill the report afterwards.
If this is something that sounds interesting, drop me a message, 4001. I will reply with the Season Marketing message. Email, rather, so you can get in touch with them direct through the website. Can I ask you, Imani, are you a bit of a tricky customer? What are your standards like when it comes to customer service around malls and stores?
I'm one of the pickiest customers. So usually if I'm happy or impressed with anyone, I go tell them, if you got a good feedback from me, it means you're really good. Because, I get exposed to different, like really high standards of customer service in different sectors. So, and this is what I do for a living. I've been doing this for over 10 years. Besides, before that, my background is also for customer service. So you find me very picky. My standards start with the smile I get when I enter the shop, the interaction that I get with the staff. What matters a lot to me is the style of the salesperson and the cleanliness of the store. I know some other people pick on different things, like what I tell my account managers usually. It's better to send people from different backgrounds, because if I care about grooming, another person would care about the selling techniques, mm-hmm. and the third person would care about the cleanliness of the shop, while the fourth person would care about the display. So this is how we capture the whole picture. I'm the worst mystery shopper that anyone could send to his business, because usually if I find the average score for a place is like 80%, when I go the score 60, because I really pick on everything.
So can I ask you then, if anyone's listening and they want to work in sales, what kind of advice would you give them to become a really effective salesperson without overstepping those boundaries that we're hearing about, you know, being followed around pharmacies or, you know, ignored? And I've worked in sales, and I think it's a fantastic, you know, if you like selling and you like people and you love the product, most importantly, that you're working with, it's an incredible thing to do. But what would your, you know, given your years of experience, any advice?
Yeah, the first thing, they should know their product very well. And as you say, they should have passion to it. They should be convinced with their product. So knowledge is number one. Even if they don't have the training tools or like...
Oh, we've just dropped you again. Would you, if you wouldn't mind...
convinced.
There you go.
Because it's going to reflect. It's going to show to your customer. You're not 100% confident with it. I always say I'm not a very good salesperson, for example, but when it comes to explaining about my product and services, I know how to explain everything in details, and that's what sells. That's what really sells. Mm-hmm. Confidence shows. And then the second thing I would say, listen to your customers. Let them do most of the talking. That's why we have two ears and one mouth. So we should listen twice more than we speak. Ask the right questions, show empathy, and then also show some elegance when you sell, like have a style.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I like it. Message here saying, what kind of money do you make as a mystery shopper? Great question. We've got lots of people interested as well. So if you do want the details of Season Marketing, just message me on 4001. I will send that over. What kind of compensation do you get if you're looking to spend, you know, part time? So I don't know, say 3 to 6 hours a week.
Okay, free. doesn't work like that, really. Okay. I have mystery shoppers who make very less money, like a couple of hundred dirhams. We have mystery shoppers who do 3,000-4,000 dirhams a month. It depends on the nature of the assignment. It depends on the requirements of the clients. And it depends on their availability. As I said, it's a part-time job that they do besides their actual job. So it's not a major income. It's just for extra cash in their pocket.
Okay.
So mystery shoppers who could do one assignment per day, that takes at least like, let's say 3 hours from the time they reach the place, they evaluate, they come back and fill the report, they would make an average of, let's say, 2,500 to 3,000 dirhams a month.
Okay, hope that helps.
While some,
yeah,
they have only weeks, they can make up to 300 to 500 dirhams a month.
Okay.
Extra cash.
Good to know. Thank you. We all need a side hustle.
Yeah.
And lastly, Aman, if you could wave a magic wand, and I'm not necessarily talking about the salespeople now, because I think it is really important to establish the pressure that a lot of these individuals are under, and that pressure comes from above. But if you could pass a message on to the training managers, to the employees, the team leaders, about what customers actually want, what would you like to see changed? And let's focus on shops rather than restaurants or hospitality. That customer experience.
That customer experience. Okay, so I would say treat the customers as individuals. Try to understand their needs and try to go that extra mile all the time.
And also, you mentioned before the importance of a good smile from the beginning. We're wearing masks right now. What about customer service during the pandemic?
Who doesn't need a smile? We all love to see smiley faces, whether like we're buying something or not. I mean, it's like smile makes break lots of ice. Like if you look at someone in any place and they smile, it breaks lots of ice. I believe smile is a magic one. Yes.
Okay, there you go. Thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Amani joining us, co-founder at CISA Marketing.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.